to open up a work session on House Bill 2251, which is the removal fill pilot permit pilot program. We just need a couple more. Actually, we don't have a quorum yet because they just stepped out.
Here's the representative. Brother.
Okay, so we're okay now. I thought he was in the room somewhere. Patrick, thank you for being here. I know that Director Soliday couldn't be here today, so I wanted to just make sure that if there were any remaining questions from the committee members, and also if you could explain the handouts, the lovely handouts that we got with the flowchart. Colleagues, if you remember, this will have a referral to Ways and Means because this is also part of a policy option package that the Department of State Lands has. But Patrick, if you could just sort of give us a brief reminder and then maybe walk us through this handout, that would be helpful.
Certainly, thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Patrick Allen, I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. This is related to House Bill 2251, which authorizes a pilot process for dealing with removal fill permits. At the last hearing, you asked for a flow chart of what's the system look like now and what will it look like for projects going through the pilot, with the general caveat that every single removal fill permit is its own animal and really has its own flow chart and may differ greatly from one to the next. This is sort of a conceptual level view of what the system looks like, and let me run you very quickly through that. In the current system, someone will apply to the Department of State Lands over on the left-hand side and begin going through the removal fill permit process. That involves the agency circulating comments to a wide range of other state agencies who will pass those comments back to DSL. Box drops down then, and DSL, assuming that that we're talking about an approval and not a denial, DSL will issue a removal fill permit with conditions. And those conditions will do a couple of things, among others. Some of those conditions go back to those agencies you see there where they have to resolve an issue. Others require the applicant to go back to the agency to actually get a subsequent permit. And so strung out the right-hand side of that flowchart are those other permits. And some conditions may only have one permit associated. Others may have many, so this is a little bit of a kind of a worst-case scenario. And we've also kind of showed you the fact that in many instances, those permits chain one after the other so that you deal with one agency, and when you're done, you go to the next agency, and you're done. Up at the top, then, is kind of one of the significant problems we're trying to address is that you may be in the middle of permit process, too, and the agency is fine with what you're doing but has some significant change you have to make to the project. That causes you to effectively have to go back to the beginning of the process and go back to DSL for modification of your DSL permit and start some version of the whole thing over again. And so you can end up in this loop that you can cycle through many times, a few times not at all, but it's the inherent, I think, frustration that often happens in the system. So if you look at the after scenario, there's, I think, three main things to point out to you. First of all, before you apply, there's this pre-application conference. You can get them today, but the monkey is on the back of the applicant. They're the ones who have to call and convene the pre-application conference in the pilot. Department of State Lands takes responsibility for doing that, and agencies have an obligation to participate in a meaningful way. The application permit process begins, and now instead of this comment and response kind of a cycle, Department of State Lands is responsible for actually pulling those agencies together, identifying problems, if they need to be worked out or if there are conflicts, getting them taken care of and fixing them. That goes back to DSL then, and DSL now does something, the third thing that's new. They issue a removal fill permit bundled with other permits, and so that P1, P2, P3 you see correspond to the earlier individual permits on the larger sheet. There may still be, and almost certainly will still be, some individual things that have to be applied for, but instead of being chained together, we hope that we'll be able, in most cases, to have them stacked so they can be done at the same time. And then the big stop sign is simply to illustrate the notion that what we hope is that you end up not having those 11th hour problems that crop up and cause you to have to go back to the beginning of the process because you've already had a couple of different opportunities to resolve those issues ahead of time. That's the really fast version. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay. There are other questions? Representative Cannon?
Madam Chair, I just have a comment, and that is a note of appreciation to the Department for preparing these, although it may not look on the surface less complex under the second condition, the post-streamlined process. It is quite clear from your explanation that it is, and this certainly helps my understanding a lot, so I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Patrick, I guess my question is, Section 2 of this bill repeals this whole program January 2, 2010, and I was curious, A, why that's the case, and B, might we want to include some requirements for some reporting and feedback to the legislature on how much this actually saved, how effective this was, so that in 2010 we might want to renew it or renew the authorization?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, the reason for the sunset was simply the stage of where we were with stakeholders, both in development of this and as a result, Director Soliday talked to you about the SPGP, the State Programmatic General Permit. We were in a state of a lot of nervousness all the way around about what was this going to look like. And so we figured in terms of prudence, designing a pilot that clearly would go away so that we'd have to come back and make the argument that it was effective would be the most effective way to deal with this issue. And our presumption is in making that argument, we would come back with that kind of information rather than adding a specific reporting requirement.
And just to follow up, Representative Burley, we will definitely be asking the department to come in and give us status sort of updates. I think that'll be part of the discussion and the Ways and Means process as well. So I appreciate that. Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Burley's concern on the sunset that is in here, I don't have any problem with the idea of the sunset in here. I think it's a good idea. However, I do have a problem with the sunset only being, in essence, two years out. I think on a pilot project, it may take more than 2 years for us to be able to gather the data that would be needed. I would be more comfortable, Madam Chair, if this were a four-year or 2012 instead of 2010. Because it's going to take a year before this thing ever gets anywhere anyway. So you got the short part of one interim in order to be able to gather enough data to come back to the legislature to provide us, with rationale and reasoning for moving forward. And I'd be more comfortable with more complete data.
Patrick, was this a discussion item in the stakeholder group? And I think we have
Kevin Moynihan is here.
Yeah,
as well.
Kevin Moynihan from the department that might like to address that as well.
Yeah, while he's coming up, Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, I don't think there would be a concern about a longer sunset on that. We were in an abundance of caution, put a leash on it, make it be a short leash. But if you're comfortable with that being longer, I there's no reason that we wouldn't be comfortable with that.
Unless
Kevin tells me I'm wrong.
Madam Chair, if I can editorialize that, in the sense of getting started. I'm not trying to give the department free rein on anything, nor am I trying to I think it's only fair that there be adequate time to be able to gather the data that we need or that you need to bring to us, and I don't know that 2 years is an adequate time for that. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Moynihan, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands, Wetland and Waterway Conservation Division. If I may answer the question of Representative Jensen. Representative Jensen, members of the committee, we'll have almost two plus years to run the project through. The department feels we would be able to get adequate information over that two-year period. Two full years of running the program would probably produce adequate information to make decisions on future implementation, to take it past the pilot project. However, we wouldn't object to a four-year period, but we do think a two-year period would be adequate to get that information.
Okay. I see that the director is here. I don't know if the Director Soliday, would you like to come up? There's discussion about extending the sunset. Now, just to note that this does still have to go to Ways and Means, and that funding would be for just the next biennium. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct for a two-year period, funding for the biennium. We're asking for one additional position.
Okay. Well, I'd be happy to.
Madam Chair.
I guess we are not doing conceptual amendments, but.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to be an obstacle on this, and I'm just merely expressing that it is my concern that we may not have all the information we want, and I certainly will be angry if they ask for 2 years and they come back 2 years from now and I sit on this committee and they come in and say, whoops, we really needed some more time because we're, I'm going to be inclined to say sorry about that.
Representative Cannon?
Well, I was going to make a motion if you're willing to entertain one.
And the department is okay with that?
Madam Chair, we prefer to have a two-year period, but if it's a four-year pilot project, we'll work with that, too.
Madam Chair, if that's what they want, then, you know, I'm going to go with their what they
want. If you feel that the 2 years will be adequate, and I'm looking over, seeing nods coming from the director, then that's fine. I do agree with Representative Jensen. We want to make sure that we have adequate information to make a decision by the next biennium. If you feel that 2 years will provide adequate, you know, time frame.
Madam Chair, one thing to consider, we've already spent almost 2 years setting up the program. We've got everything in place, so we'll be ready to jump off and run with it almost immediately, assuming we get the position authority that we're looking for. So we're not going to plan it and eat up to half a year out of that 2 year period.
Okay.
We're ready
that,
to go.
That's helpful, Kevin. Yeah. Appreciate that. Say, any other questions or comments? Okay, so I will certainly entertain a motion, and thank you for your input, Representative. Appreciate that.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Ways and Means Subcommittee, Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, those of the opinion that House Bill 2251 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Excused.
Representative Fire?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Dinkfelder?
Aye. Motion having received the majority is declared passed. And I'm not going to assign a carrier. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2251 because this will be referred to Ways and Means. Thank you. Okay, next we are going to continue the hearing on House Bill 2101, which we had to carry over from our last session. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2101. This is relating to fees for the Water Resources Department. We have Phil Ward from the Water Resources Department up again and a couple of other people who would like to come up. And then we have some folks left over from last time that wanted to testify. And I don't know if we have a... Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, Phil Ward with the department. We wanted to just say a couple quick things. Also wanted to give you a look at a real live water resource commissioner.
A live one?
A live one.
Natural habitat.
I thought he'd be wetter.
And he may have a comment or two, but I just wanted to summarize a little bit of what we said. Last time we were with you, there's another handout that I hope is going around now that we hope was responsive to some of the questions that came forward. But again, if I could, just a quick reminder that this is a fee bill from the department. It supports two basic programs, the Water Right Permitting Program and the Water Right Transfer Program. And these programs provide direct service to our customers around the state. Today we're down to about 20% of the fees supporting that program versus the 30%, and the fund is not stable past the end of this biennium without this fee adjustment, without these fee adjustments. These fee adjustments get us four more years at our current service level to our customers. And the fees don't represent, as was brought up the other day, an across-the-board increase, and that's, you see a range of increases in fees, and what we've tried to do here is actually reflect the amount of work it takes us to process an application in the percentage increase that these fees represent. And then the last thing I would note, Madam Chair and members, is just this little handout here that shows you the disposition of the Water Right Fund. The current fund is the sharply declining line on the left. And then you can see if these fees are enacted, that fund will increase, will carry a little bit of balance, but by the time we get to the end of the next biennium, again, we'll be dipping down in terms of the fees being able to support the program. And so we would probably, in 4 years from now, return for another incremental type of adjustment. So that, Madam Chair, it may be that Commissioner Rasmussen just would have a brief comment in terms of the Commission's views on these, with your permission.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for being here, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jay Rasmussen, for the record. I'm in my fifth year on the Commission. I'm the Vice Chair of it, and I'm glad I'm alive and fairly lively. I'm not overly wet today, but coming from Newport, I probably should be a little salty, but I'd probably not even be that, at least. It's a great opportunity just to add a couple comments. The Commission has been very pleased with the Department's ability over the last 4 or 5 years that I've been involved to be efficient, to be able to meet a lot of stakeholder and customer needs with essentially a declining budget. It's very heavily on general fund, and fees do not support much of our budget. And the Commission, I think, unanimously has been concerned about that problem of fees. We've had a lot of stakeholders in support of fee increases because they see the direct results of those for specific programs. So we thought, the Commission thought, that the fees that we're talking about here were at a minimum, in a sense, just to try to keep us up even during this next biennium. So we do very much support the Department in this, and would hope that you will hear others today in support of these fees, and that you would be supportive as well. So.
Thank you very much for being here, and we appreciate your service.
Thank you.
As well. Are there any questions for the Commissioner or for Phil Ward?
I'll wait till we hear the other.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have several people that signed up last time, and I'm assuming they still would like to speak, so I'm going to call up three at a time so we can move through this pretty quickly. Willie Tiffany from the League of Oregon Cities, Amanda Rich from Special Districts, and then I have Nicholas Blair. I don't know if Nicholas is in the audience. Okay.
Beauty before age?
No. Hey, we'll start with you, Willie. Okay. You drew the short straw.
Okay, age first, I suppose. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and we're happy to support House Bill 2101 today. I want to commend the department on really going through an extensive stakeholder process in terms of developing this fee package. As was noted, I believe on Wednesday, this restores the traditional level of fee payer to general fund for this department to 70% general fund and 30% fee, and we're supportive of that. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but the League of Oregon Cities is happy to support House Bill 2101.
Okay, great. Thank you. Amanda?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon today. And I would echo Willie's comments and add that in my experience in working with agencies, I don't think I've met a better team to work with, frankly. They are incredible at involving their stakeholders, and it's a real partnership between them and the folks that they regulate and work with, and it has been a real pleasure working with them. And a functioning and efficient Water Resources Department is so important to our districts, and I would just urge your support of House Bill 2101.
Thank you. Nicholas?
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, thank you for seeing me today. My name is Nick Baer, and I serve as Senator Whitsitt's policy advisor. It is granted that increases in fees are necessary from time to time in order to keep up with inflation. It is also granted that in some cases, increasing complexity results in more time being required to complete tasks. However, in general, increased workload should be funded by increased number of fees rather than by increasing the amount of the fee. Some of Oregon Water Resource Department's fee enhancements amount to a 60 to 70% increase. Our constituents are concerned that cost analysis data to justify the amount of the fee increases have not been made available on a fee-by-fee basis. The possible significance of line 40 to 42 are apparent when we apply them to the proposed Long Lake project in Klamath County. The application estimation by OWRD would cost $80 plus $20 per acre foot of storage. 350,000 acre feet of storage, which is proposed, times $20 per acre foot, would cost us $7 million to have the application reviewed, plus the $80 fee. So it would cost us $7,080,000.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for
panel? Well, just a comment, Madam mm-hmm. Chair, and I think the director's busily doing his math there, but this was one of the things I wanted to kind of key in on, because we were dropping in this proposed language what used to be a cap on that particular fee, and I was curious mm-hmm. what the rationale was for that.
Well, I probably should ask the director to come back up, but thank you. Any questions for this panel in particular? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, with your permission, we'll get some folks that really know the answer.
No, here.
Okay. Good afternoon, Debbie.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department. And I guess I'll start in a response to the comment and perhaps have Dwight French, who's the Water Rights and Adjudication Administrator for our department, add to whatever additional information you might need. I think that the section of the bill that was referred to, lines starting at 40, mm-hmm. that's what we think of as our small ponds applications. So these are smaller reservoir applications. They can't exceed 9.2. They're basically either have a dam of 10 feet or less, mm-hmm. or store less or 9.2 acre feet of storage. And so I think for the particular storage project that was being referred to, it wouldn't come under that portion of our fee schedule. Instead, it would come under the section that is for larger storage projects. And so I guess with that, if it's okay with you, Madam Chair, I'd just ask Dwight to add another comment on that.
And is that, can you just reference what line that's in? And is that fee being proposed for change as well? That would be helpful to clarify for the record.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dwight French, and Debbie introduced me.
Can you just state you're with the Water Resources
yes,
Department?
Yes, I'm with the Water Resource Department and the Administrator of the Water Rights and Adjudication Division. And there's been some concern in the past about the small ponds occasionally being used, that process being used for very large storage projects. And in the past, there has been a cap on the amount of fees, regardless of how much you wanted to store. And removing that cap language might self-select some larger projects that might still have a small dam but want to store a large amount of water into the regular process where there's more public input and more public notice. So that was part of the idea of removing the cap, is that some large projects might then be self-selecting to have to go through the larger or regular reservoir process.
Do you want to have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Well, so 537-409, which is what defines the small project, that, I mean, that has an actual size limit on it, doesn't it? So in effect, that would serve as a cap on the total cost anyways.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the language in 537-409 says you must either have a reservoir of 9.2 acre feet or a dam less than 10 feet high. So it's possible that if you want to build a 9-foot high dam but store a couple of years ago, we had 150,000 acre-foot storage project behind a small dam, and there's not much public notice. Even the criteria to review a project like that is pretty narrow, because it was really meant for the smaller projects. So that's some of the backstory about removing the cap.
Okay, clarification. So if I had a 10-foot high dam that was
100,000 acre foot, then you're saying there's a cap. I wouldn't have to pay that $20 per acre foot, or I would have to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and sir, currently there is a cap on the maximum amount of fee that you would have to pay of $250, and in the fee bill we're removing the cap. So for a small dam, but a big storage project, the fees would be quite large.
So we have a clarification here.
I think Nicholas, this will help you understand this. So in a large project such as what's being proposed down in Klamath County, where's the fee in here that would be associated with a project such as that?
Madam Chair and Representative Burley, you can use the regular reservoir process for any size of reservoir. And the fees are actually cheaper for the large projects to go through the regular process. If I can see your copy, I'll point you to the line number.
Thank you.
It's line number 19 to store water under ORS 537-400. And that's the statute that talks about the regular process.
It's line 19, page 1. Okay, thank you.
At section 1, subsection B. Okay. And I will encourage you, if you have any questions, maybe you can talk offline to make sure and address the senator's staff's question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next I'm going to call up the, and I'm going to ask all of you to come up together, even though you're not all on the same page, just to save time here. So Dave Moskowitz from Water Watch. I don't know, is David here? Okay. Richard Kosasan. And we'll have Jerry Schmidt come up. And actually, you know what, Scott? Why don't you be ready to come up right afterwards? So we can make sure and move this hearing along. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. David, you want to start?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, here today for Water Watch of Oregon. And there's written testimony being distributed about this bill, HB 2101, the fee adjustment or fee increase. That was an interesting discussion the other day. Department of Forestry now calls clear cuts regeneration harvests. So, you know, the terminology changes regularly. On these things.
We're not going to go there in this committee. So
very good. These fee adjustments, Water Watch supports many of them. We have a few specific points we'd like to make today. One, while much has been made about returning the department to at least a 30% recovery of its cost of service, as a policy matter, it would be, Water Watch believes that the legislature should look at trying to increase the cost recovery on natural resource agencies, which have suffered through a lot of budget cuts over many years. But we're pleased that it's beginning to at least catch back up. But we think that heading towards one-half or 50% of the cost of service is a reasonable direction for state agencies to aim towards. Second, this is a particular aspect of the bill in Section 1, and Water Watch supports this proposed fee associated with fees for additional use or points of diversion, and the department proposes to now assess fees for if you're drilling four wells instead of just one. Instead of paying just one fee, you're paying a fee for each well drilled or transfer, and we support that section. The principal issue we'd like to raise today deals with the proposed increase in protest fees. The proposal raises the fee from $250 to $350. In 1995, that fee was only about $25. It went up to $200 subsequent to that. We believe that having a fee for the public to get involved in water right decision by the department, that a higher fee chills public participation in the in the management of a public resource. This fee increase is not an issue. The amount of this fee increase is not an issue for Water Watch as an organization, which does file protests with the department. But for the general public, for private citizens, we believe it starts to chill their involvement. The basic inequity, however, in this particular section under protest is that a water right applicant, if they protest a decision by the Water Resources Department, they don't pay a fee to protest that decision. And somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% of all protests are filed by applicants. Water Watch would support applying this fee or increasing this fee if everybody who filed a protest actually had to pay that fee. But right now, the public, the third-party public, bears the burden on that protest fee. We'd like the committee to consider either asking the department to increase the people who are subject to that fee, or potentially not increasing that fee. The last point, and this is on standing statements, which is a statement. You have to file a small fee for filing a statement of standing, which is essentially your interest in the issue. And this is before you would go to a contested case. People who are interested in a decision have to pay a fee for the statement of standing. We believe that the Water Resource Department doesn't conduct any analysis in most of those cases of standing, and you have anyone who files that statement actually has to file, if they're going to get involved in a contested case, then they have to actually file that contested case fee subsequent to that, and that should cover the standing determination can be covered there. So we think that fee is unnecessary. Again, though, our major point, though, is with the protest fees, and we think that if all applicants, everybody who files a protest has to pay, that's the most reasonable way to approach that. And that's all the testimony I have today. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for the opportunity.
David, I have a quick question regarding, and I can ask the department this as well, do you know how many protests per year filed with the department on average?
I don't have that information right here, but I have received that information from the department, and I believe that the staff that's here today can probably answer that question directly.
I'll have that come up after this panel.
Okay,
thank you. Any other questions for David?
Questions now?
Yeah, we'll take questions for David, then we'll move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. David, I hear this argument quite often in various cases, but I guess my question is if you don't like having to pay the protest fee or the contested case fee, would Water Watch be willing to post a bond so that the applicant could recoup costs if Water Watch were not to prevail?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Burley, I believe the answer to that is going to be absolutely no. But let me just make sure that I misspoke, but we are not opposed to paying the fees for contested cases. We're just saying the standing statement, it's a separate small fee, and it's that was where Water Watch believes that there shouldn't. It's on page 2 of my testimony, near the last paragraph. We're not opposed to the contested case fee, so I want to make sure that's clear. Okay. We're not opposed to the protest fee. We just want it to be more equitably applied. And I'll just finish by saying, no, we would not like to have to post a bond.
Any other questions for Dave before we move on? One quick one. If I recall right, I think the first time I sat in the Water Committee with Representative Jensen, I think we heard about the protest fee being raised. So do you recall when the last time the fee for protest was increased?
I believe it was in 2000, but I think that you might want to check with Phil and Debbie.
Yeah. They're taking notes. Come back up. Okay. Thank you. Richard.
Thank you.
Like your tie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Kosasan with Water for Life.
It's purple for those in the back that can't see. Sorry, I got you off track.
It was dark this morning. Very, very briefly, Madam Chair, Water for Life, while I think it appreciates the situation and the financial situation facing the department, we believe and we would hope that the fees, the proposed fee increases, may indeed receive some further examination and hopefully room for moderation throughout the process. If we take a look, for example, I think we have some inconsistencies. For a number of years, the state and the legislative body has looked to provide incentive to encourage conservation storage. And we turn around and we substantially increase the fees for such storage. Stored water, as you will find, lines 19, 20, page 1, we face a 66% increase in the base fee for storage. Lines 27, recording a permit for stored water, goes facing an increase of 20%. We look at the storage provisions, page 2, lines 40 to 42. We're looking at substantial increases there. And to me, that is somewhat contradictory to even current concepts to promote storage. We look at Senate Bill 600, the statewide supply and conservation assessment, and that concept, I think, has been floating around here for the last three or four sessions, which I think is a very prudent course. But when we, I think, turn around and increase the fees, I think we perhaps lose the incentive for such factors as storage. With that, again, in terms of Water for Life, we would hope that there would be some moderation to these fees and go from there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Any questions? Okay. Sherry? I like your tie as well.
Thank you.
Nice elk.
I like Richard. I can remember last session I came in with two different colored shoes. I did this in the dark, so at least I got the same color shoes on. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. These are the men and women principally dealing with groundwater, as the name would have it. These are consulting engineers, hydrogeologists, well constructors, pump installers, water treatment folks, the whole gamut of people dealing with water under the surface of the ground. I gave you kind of a brief background statement of where we've been as an association and some of the things that we've tried to do in helping promote the department into a digital format and increasing their ability to computerize their records. When it gets down to the fee bill, we have made some comments, particularly our consulting hydrogeologists, the issues about points of diversion. Many of our hydrogeologists, when they're making application to the departments, they'll identify multiple points of diversion because they don't know until they get on the property whether or not it's going to take one well, two wells, or four wells to reach what they need as part of the application package. And instead of starting all over again after they get there and drill one well and find it's not successful or they have to move it, they have to go through the process. So I guess the explanation that I give you there, I gave you on the second side of the page that I handed to you. The department produced a document that shows what would happen under the new price structure if you had four wells, two uses, three CFS, and they tried to go through the how this bill would impact. And you can see that under the current process, the fee would be $950. Under the new process, in this bill, it would be $2,000. Now, our issue here is you could do some minor twists to that and probably come up with the same amount of money, but lower the overall increase. So, for instance, you could increase the amount of the base fee, but decrease the additional points of diversion. And our hydrogeologists point out that, in fact, once you pull all the maps and once you do all the work, it's a little easier to do the second and third points of diversion than it is the first. Department tried to speak to that and lowered it to 200 instead of the 600, but I think they can twist this a little bit. And on the second part there, I showed you what would happen if you raise the base fee $100 and decrease the point of diversion to $50. You can see the increase goes from 950 to 1300. So those are the kind of examples that you can do. If you're still working with the same amount of money, I agree with Richard. I hope when this bill gets down to your committee, Madam Chair, in Ways and Means, that you can probably modify some of these things. And the department, I know, has been working on some of these figures, trying to make some modifications. So with that, ends my testimony. We are generally supportive of fees, but only in proportion. And when you get into some of these larger proportions, it's very hard for an applicant to stay, sticker shock when you run a doubling and tripling of fees. So anyway, we're supportive, and we will continue to be supportive. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Appreciate your comments. Are there any questions? No? Okay. Thank you. And Scott? Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 2101? I see Ms. Winkler in the back. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. We're all fairly large growers and use a fair amount of irrigation and nursery use water. That's the nature of our interest in it. We're not deliriously happy, but happy enough to support House Bill 2101. We have a policy in the organization that basically supports reasonable fee increases that are commensurate to the cost of providing the service. And we think that this bill gets the Water Resource Department a little bit closer to being able to collect from the applicant for the reasonable services that it provides. So we're in support of it. I am not going to bore you with any minute criticisms of the bill. You've heard a few, and they're pretty well placed in some cases. If, in the wisdom of this committee, you decide to pursue adjusting the bill by use of an advisory committee or something, I'd like to be part of that process if I could. If you don't and you want to support the bill as is, that's fine with us. We're in support of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. And Anita, why don't you go ahead and then if you can hang out for any questions.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, excuse me just a second. Thank you, Bill.
I didn't know he was on staff with you, so helping you out.
That will cost me later.
Yeah, I was going to say. He's full service, I think.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We're here today to testify in support of the bill and appreciate the opportunity. Our support is really based on three principles that we've carried for a long time in looking at the department's budget and their fees. And the first is that 4 or 5 years ago, the department reached an agreement with their stakeholders that they would come to you with gradual fee increases every couple of years instead of doing it every 5 or 7 or however many years when we were facing 200 and 300% increases in the fees. So first, they're living up to their agreement, and we greatly appreciate that they're following that agreement that we reached. Secondly, we support the effort to keep the fees at least at 30% of the cost of the department, and which ties to my third point is we've worked very hard in the past to ensure the department had a budget that allows them to get the work done. Our interest is in getting all the applications processed so that our members know what water they have to work with in an irrigation season. And we see this as an integral part of them being able to do their work and process everything that comes across their desks. So you have the rest of my testimony in writing. I won't try and read it all to you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for either of the committee or any of the witnesses up here? Okay. Thank you. later. Philip, did you want to come up and respond to any of the questions that came up while you're here, and then we will close this public hearing?
So, Madam Chair, I think we all took some notes during the time, but just a couple of things that I noted. I think the last time the protest fee was raised was the 03 session, was it not? And I think it's important just to clarify a little bit how that works. That protest fee is paid by non-applicants, so folks that want to join the process at that point. It's been our view, and I think continues to be as an agency, that the applicants buy their way into that process with the initial application fee and all the other fees that are associated with bringing a water right into existence clear to the certificate piece. So that protest fee is the one that's being raised at that level is related to folks that join the process as non-applicants. It is true that the majority of our protests are from applicants themselves, but we have not chosen to assess them a different fee, an additional fee for that privilege to this point. We certainly could do that if that were the pleasure of the committee. The other thing I would just mention again quickly, what we've tried to do here and is, again, not just doing across-the-board general fee increase, but try and match the workload generated by some of this activity to the fees. So when I certainly understand Mr. Schmidt's concern about the additional fee every time you add an additional point of diversion or additional well, say, to a groundwater application, that creates a new burden upon the applicant. Indeed, today, though, there's no way for the department to recoup its costs for doing that work. Given the state of the resource today, now we have to do an extensive analysis for every groundwater application, a science-based analysis as to whether there's water available, whether that new use will impact other water users, and a variety of other things. I'll conclude, Madam Chair.
Well, I was just going to say, just a clarification, except for the exempt groundwater.
Thank you, Madam Chair, except for exempt groundwater wells. So what certainly we're open to to adjusting as the committee sees fit the levels of fees in different categories. But really what we've tried to do there is reflect the workload. That's the spirit in which we built this package. And certainly we have been talking about it with these folks for some time. I believe that relates to the notes I took, Madam Chair. Debbie, do you have anything that you feel like we need to add?
Well, Madam Chair, I think there was one other question. You just asked how many protests we receive mm-hmm. on average. We get about 12 a year, and I think that you also had a question. You also had a question about how many from Water Watch in particular, and they in the last year about 7. So it gives you kind of a rough idea in response to that question.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the department?
Before? Just a clarification on
Representative Cannon.
Thank you. That's 12 non-applicant protests.
Madam Chair, okay. Representative, that is correct.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. All right, thank you. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2101. And I just want to let folks in the audience know and committee members that we have Metro Councilor Bragdon here to testify on House Bill 2118 and I'm sorry 2051, and unfortunately has another commitment. So I'm going to just quickly open up the hearing on House Bill 2051 and ask President Bragdon to testify, and then we will close that and open up the hearing on House Bill 2118. Do you want to come up, Randy, as well? And do you want to have a description of the bill just for the committee?
Sure.
Okay. So I am now going to open up a public hearing on House Bill, make sure I get the numbers right, 2051. Pat's going to give a brief description. We have a lot of people from out of town who came here to testify in 2118, so that's why we're going to close this public hearing and reopen it at the end if we have time. Thank you for being here. Kat's going to give a quick description of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2051 extends from 5 years to 7 years the schedule for Metro to complete an inventory determination and analysis of housing capacity and need within the urban growth boundary.
Thank you, and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. Appreciate the chance to be with you. Public hearings are often places that we learn a lot of things in elective office, and like you, I've had some memorable hearings where a light bulb goes off in my head about the public policies that we pursue. Two that come to mind as we address this topic today was a very eventful 600-person hearing in Wilsonville on the topic of moving the urban growth boundary that ended at about midnight with the question, how soon are you going to be back here asking us about this? This was a question asked by one of the citizens about the frequency of urban growth boundary hearings in our region and the contention that they provide. The other light bulb moment at a public hearing for me was during one of our recent deliberations about the urban growth boundary was having back-to-back testimony from an environmental group and a development group from very different perspectives, but both of them with what, in my mind, were very valid complaints about the process that we use to expand the urban growth boundary. And while those complaints that they had were not the same complaints, they both indicated the need to study what we're doing and to try to do things better. Actually, the origins of what we're talking about today actually predate my career and I think probably your careers in the offices that you're in. This statute that we're here talking, the requirement that we're talking about actually dates back to the mid-1990s when the state law was amended to require our organization, exclusively among others in the state, to review the urban growth boundary on a 5-year basis. At the same time, the Metro Council of the time, working with local governments in the district, was adopting the 2040 concept, a long-term view of how the region should grow. We're now more than 10 years into experience with those tools that we had, that we inherited from the mid-1990s, and we've learned things along the way. We've done a lot of urban growth boundary expansions, over 23,000 acres within that period, for example. And we've learned where we're falling short in fulfilling the 2040 concept, and we've learned where we're doing well. There's broad consensus among the local governments in our region, as well as with our council, that there are two things that need to be done in terms of reforming the system of growth management. The first is to update the financial tools that we use to fulfill where and how infrastructure and other public services are provided, the financial tools, both public and private, that relate to how growth is managed. And the second are the mechanisms that we use to expand the urban growth boundary when we do so, and the criteria that we use and the decisions that we make. Those are two very big topics and are going to take some time and finesse to work through. And we have a lot of commitment from a variety of partners in our region to work through those issues, not just on the government side, but within the development community as well. But we can't do either of those things if instead we get back on the treadmill of expanding the urban growth boundary in this calendar year, which is what we would have to do if the current statute is not amended. Under the current statute, we would be required to again start assessing expanding the urban growth boundary in this calendar year and make a decision about moving it in 2008. This is at a time when we still have not gotten the order from LCDC pertaining to the last urban growth boundary expansion. More to the point, it's also before virtually any of the acres that we've brought into the urban growth boundary in past cycles have been developed. And that's primarily a matter of infrastructure and finance. We have made some strides toward that, which Randy will talk about in a moment with regard to planning in those areas. But because of the complexity of the structure that we're working under, my point is that we're barely finishing one cycle before we're put back on what Chair Schrader says, Chair Schrader of the Clackamas County Commission, in a letter submitted to you today, refers to as the treadmill of urban growth boundary expansions in her letter of, on behalf of her commission, asking you to support this bill. Our immediate problem now is not a lack of available land. We've brought in over 23,000 acres, and as we'll show you, on that 23,000 acres, approximately 1,500 dwelling units have been built over the last 10 years. very, very much underperformance. And again, that's an issue of the financial capacity or the willingness of the general fund taxpayer to pay for new services and new infrastructure at the edge of town. Until that issue gets resolved, further expansions of the urban growth boundary really don't serve anybody. Conducting all the analysis that goes into it and diverting our citizens from trying to improve their existing communities is also a distraction from this complicated work that I've just described that we're undertaking. We have worked a lot on this legislative agenda. We have a package. This bill is one of several that we will be bringing forward to you with unprecedented wide support from the local governments in our region. A companion bill to this relates to a better process for designating urban reserves for long term, and we hope that when the time comes that you will also support that. We see these as a companion package, and we're also working with the statewide committee, which I happen to be on as well, in terms of the overall process itself, and you'll be hearing from the Big Look committee about that in 2009. Pending all of that, we'd appreciate your support for this bill. I'd like to defer to Mr. Tucker if there are any details he would like to add, and I appreciate any questions that you may have for us.
Thank you. Randy, why don't you go ahead first, and we'll see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, Metro's Legislative Affairs Manager. I think the first thing I should do is, this is a bill that changes one word and it's in the statute, and yet I've handed you, several pages of paper, and there are very large implications for the change of that one word. Obviously, well, not obviously, but at the end of the day, it'll change a few more words because we need couple of amendments, but I wanted to just walk you through the paperwork and then tell you a brief story and then over and out for me. First page obviously is just a summary of our rationale. The second sheet of paper is a resolution that was adopted unanimously by the Metro Policy Advisory Committee, our MPAC. MPAC is consists largely of local government officials from around the region, as well as some agency representatives and some citizens, and the list of the members of MPAC is on the back of that sheet. And you'll notice that item one, extend the region's urban growth boundary evaluation cycle by 2 years. That is this bill that's before you today. And as I say, this resolution was adopted unanimously by MPAC on the region's behalf. The next page, let's skip over this. Let me tell you my story associated with this press release here. Metro awards $6.3 million. Last session, Metro brought forward a bill that was virtually identical to the bill that's before you today. It was Senate Bill 245. And at the time, we went to work trying to negotiate with the development community, who was the main constituency that had raised concerns about extending our cycle, about what it might take to win their support. And the problem that faced the region was that the land that had been brought into the urban growth boundary was not ready for development. It had not been planned. There was no money for infrastructure, etc. But of special concern at that time is that the planning was not underway, even though the land had been in the boundary for a couple of years. And so the development community, basically this was the regional home builders, realtors, associated general contractors, and other groups around the table, asked Metro to put something in the bill that would create some hard deadlines and some enforcement, basically some sanctions, for failure to meet those deadlines in terms of getting the local governments to do the planning that they were required to do once the land was brought into the boundary. Well, Metro was amenable to that, but when we talked to the local governments of the region, we got a basic reaction of show us the money. They are already strapped. They don't have the staff. They are not the ones that expanded the urban growth boundary, etc. And those were legitimate concerns, even though we were able to pass the bill through the Senate as those negotiations continued by a vote of 26-3. At the end of the day, we decided that it was not a very good idea to try to jam this bill down anybody's throat, and we pulled the plug and went back to the region to try to solve the problem that had been presented to us. And so to make a relatively long story relatively short, Metro convened a tax study committee chaired by co-chaired by, I believe, Tom Bryan, is that right? Washington County Chair Tom Bryan and the president of the Home Builders Association, Jim Chapman, and that committee committee recommended to the Metro Council the adoption of a temporary construction excise tax to raise the money to support the planning that needed to happen in the areas that were already in the urban growth boundary. And that's what this press release here describes. It's a temporary tax that sunsets as soon as the $6.3 million has been raised. That money has, the grants have been awarded, and Metro is fronting the money as the money comes in from the tax. The bottom line is that Metro was asked to do something and satisfied, we believe, both the development community who asked us to do it to get the planning underway and the local governments who did not have the funding to undertake the task. So we're back now, having accomplished that, asking for what we were asking for to begin with, which is a two-year extension of the urban growth boundary cycle. The reason, as President Bragdon said to you, that we want to do that is not just to take a vacation, but to actually do some work to improve the process for expanding the urban growth boundary. And that's what this next sheet of paper, this 11-by-17 draft roadmap, lays out for you. We're not going to walk you through all this, but it just certainly explains to you the importance of this two-year extension to allow us to do this kind of work. And finally, let me just point to the last sheet, which is also a draft, which indicates all of the areas that have been brought into the urban growth boundary in the last 9 years and how many units have been produced on them. Let me hasten to reemphasize that it's draft and that there is a later version that I just wasn't able to receive in time to bring here. And the numbers, you know, you can't hang on every single last unit, but basically you can see less than 1% of the land that's been brought into the urban growth boundary since 1998 has been developed. So I'll stop there by saying we certainly urge your support for this legislation and would be happy to answer questions and continue the discussion.
Okay, well, what I'm going to ask is, because we have a room full of people for the next bill, I'm going to ask committee members to take this information home. I know you're going to read it over the weekend and be prepared to ask questions on Monday when we're going to ask Randy to come back and other folks if we aren't able to get to it today. But while I have Councillor Bragdon here, I'd like to see if there are any questions in particular to this, because I don't think you will be back here on Monday, but I know Randy will be.
That's correct.
Representative Cannon.
Well, I guess I do have a question, and that's why, what makes you think that a two-year extension will be enough? I mean, we've seen so little progress in terms of building out the infrastructure that's already been brought in. Why are you here asking only for a two-year extension and not a five-year extension? That would, given the pace and history of this, I'd be reasonable to ask for more.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, you're correct that probably the financing issues are of a long-term duration and require a lot of reform. 2 years, though, coincides with the reforms that we expect to see in the land use system that we're responsible for, and that also coincides with the work of the State Big Look Committee. It gets us from here to 2009, so that would coincide with the legislature looking at the entire urban growth boundary and growth management system as a whole.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Bragdon, you touched on this a little bit in your testimony, and it seems to me that what this bill is doing is treating the symptom and not the problem. And the fact that if it's taking so long to get this process done, I would submit that maybe we need to look at the process, which is what you indicated you were doing, and even Randy, you've got here. So my thought is, okay, if you want a two-year timeout on this thing, so to speak, let's just give you that for 2 years, but you get back on the five-year cycle, and we solve the real problem. Because if we give you 7 years now, it's going to be Bend and then Redmond and the next city coming in asking for 7 years. And I
watch out, they're all in the audience.
I know they are. You know, so what would you think about that?
Well, Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, I'm not sure what requirements the other cities in the state are under. I believe we're the only ones that are under this type of system.
Under the five-year time frame?
Correct.
Yeah, I believe so, sir. And I think you're accurate in saying that this is not the root cause that needs to be addressed. I think what we're asking for is a pause so that we can address the root causes. And I think both the local governments and the citizens in our council, in our region, are committing to do that with the work plan over the next several years. And as I said, it coincides with the state panel doing that as well. I think in 2009, the overall system may be overhauled, that the as to whether it's a 5 or 7 or some other type of measurement at that time is completely wide open. So the implication of your question, I think, is a valid one. It would get us to the same place.
Right. Thank you.
And just for clarification, this legislation only applies to a metropolitan service district, and there is specific legislation for Metro that is different from other cities through regional planning organizations. Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, and we will look forward to a continued discussion, if not later during this hearing, then on Monday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming here today. Appreciate it. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2051 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2118, which is an underground injection control program. Kat, do you want to give us a brief description?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2118 authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to establish fees that would directly support DEQ administration of the Underground Injection Control Program. The Underground Injection Control Program protects groundwater sources from contamination by underground injection of stormwater and other wastewater.
Okay. Thank you, Kat. And I'd like to invite up Neil Mullane from the Department of Environmental Quality, and he's going to also provide a more detailed overview of the bill. Can you do me a favor? You need to sort of, if you can just add whoever's on there, and then if there's anybody over 100 miles, I need to make sure to start them so they can go first. Hi, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Jim Fowler, members of the committee. My name is Neil Mullane, and I'm the manager of the Water Quality Permits Program in DEQ's Northwest Region. And I'm here today to provide some information and background and support for House Bill 2118. House Bill 2118 would allow the Department and the Environmental Quality Commission to take the actions necessary to implement the Underground Injection Control Program of the Safe Drinking Water Act. The bill specifically allows the Commission to establish a schedule of fees for subsurface injection activities. The fees would be placed in a new subsurface injection fluid account established in Section 3 of the bill. The fees would be appropriated to the Department for administration of the program. The bill also allows the Department to exempt some of the injection activities authorized in the program from receiving permits. The Federal Safe Drinking Water Act requires the protection of drinking water quality throughout the nation. The UIC program is the program which specifically acts to regulate the injection of fluids to groundwater to protect groundwater for drinking water. And in Oregon, the citizens of Oregon rely on groundwater for their drinking water source and rely on a clean source of drinking water. About 50% of the state relies solely on groundwater for its drinking water source, and about 75% of the state relies on groundwater for a portion of its drinking water or other water needs. Now, unlike surface water, where we normally have a treatment system for that water and treat it before it's delivered to homes and customers, groundwater is not always treated prior to use. Therefore, contamination of groundwater by the injection of wastewater and stormwater poses a significant threat to the quality of that water. Now, injection systems themselves are designed to place wastewater and stormwater below the ground surface where it infiltrates into groundwater. Therefore, this activity has the potential of introducing contamination such as bacteria, oils, toxics, and heavy metals into the drinking water supply. The UIC program regulates the design and placement of these injection systems to prevent contamination. There are nearly 45,000 registered injection systems in the state, and we suspect an equal number unregistered systems in the state today. To provide some history and background, the Environmental Protection Agency in 1984 delegated primacy to the Department of Environmental Quality for the administration of the UIC program in Oregon. The department subsequently developed rules and program to implement the UIC program.
And during the time since then, the department has implemented the program with limited resources. And in the last 5 years, the program has become much more complex, and we have a lot more activity in terms of the number of requests for review and approvals. Consequently, the department finds itself in the undesirable position of having to return the program to EPA due to the lack of adequate resources. The fees collected in House Bill 2118 would allow us to provide the necessary services for a functional program, and specifically to provide technical assistance to the regulated community, developing programs for guidance, taking timely actions for the authorization of the injection fluids, developing and issuing permits in a timely manner, reviewing and revising the program rules. The last time we reviewed rules was in 2000. Establishing the outreach program for local communities. We found in this program, if we have an opportunity to sit down and discuss the program and work with local communities, we have a lot better reaction in terms of what's going on in that community and the injection activities and understanding of the program. And finally, to maintain the UIC database. Now, at this time, I would also like to offer amendments to House Bill 2118. The amendments are attached to my testimony. And those amendments would replace lines 22 and 23 of the bill. And the amendments specifically describe the fees to fund this program. The fee schedule was developed in coordination with the stakeholders, and I believe several of them will follow my testimony today. In closing, I'd like to say that the UIC program is an important component of Oregon's effort to protect groundwater quality, and specifically drinking water quality. And House Bill 2118 will provide the funding necessary for the department to implement that program. Thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Neil. Any questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Chair Dinkfelder. Mr. Merlin, I'm trying to understand what the scope of a fluid injection, subsurface injection systems is. It looks like it would apply in cases of just normal runoff from roofs, and I'm just wondering, and I saw a reference in here someplace to dry wells as being sort of a principal source. So does that mean that sort of any residential user who digs a hole and puts pea gravel into it in order to facilitate runoff as an injection fluid injection system?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, the department has really looked at this program over the years and has really tried to identify those specific injection activities where we would have contaminants associated with that injection. So house drains, roof runoff from homes and that type of thing, and injecting, no. We do not have the program looking at fees and trying to, you know, make judgments on those particular facilities. What we're looking at are large parking lots, areas where drainage is, where we would have high volumes of traffic for street traffic, where you would have contaminations like oil and toxics and heavy metals mixed in with that stormwater and then put into a system where it's actually injected or infiltrated into the groundwater. Another example might be the location of, say, a sump where a loading dock would be at an industrial facility where you might have spillage of chemicals and contaminants, and that spillage then being washed down into that sump or dry well and it then being injected into the ground.
Okay. Follow up.
So I think what I'm hearing is the fluid that is conveying the contaminants is nearly always, or in most cases, stormwater runoff. But the issue is contamination that stormwater runoff comes in contact with and then goes down and could get into the aquifer.
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, that's exactly right.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? I have a couple of quick ones for you, Neil. Regarding the items that you've listed here in your testimony that would be provided if this fee is implemented, so can you tell me of any of these six bullets what you are currently providing?
Madam Chair.
Obviously with the reviewing and revising program rules that you've already promulgated that, but so there's no program guidance now?
The program guidance is about 15 years old for this program. In terms of the, if you want me to run
down. Yeah, if you could just run down so we have a sense of where you are now in the program and what this new fee will provide.
Certainly. In terms, for example, of the timely actions in terms of authorization of the injection fluids themselves, we're right now looking at between 30 to 90 days in responding to the applications for authorization. And under this bill, the funding would help us provide that review and authorization are much quicker. We're estimating between 5 to 10 days for most of the simple systems, maybe 10 to 20 days for the medium-level systems, and up to a month or a little over a month for the very complex systems. So the funding within this bill would provide us an ability to really respond much more rapidly and to get those authorizations out.
Okay. And what is your current backlog on those?
I couldn't answer directly, Madam Chair, but we could find out the exact number of the backlog.
That would be helpful because you have, I mean, in your testimony, I think you said there's thousands, 45,000 injection systems registered. So I'd like to get a sense of how many permits you currently have that are, you know, waiting for approval. And then the other question is how often they have to be renewed. So if you can give us a sense of that.
Madam Chair, the authorizations themselves is a permanent authorization. If we were going to complex systems, we would have basically an annual update, and we'd be looking at those systems to make sure that we're reviewing the data coming from those systems and making sure that the system itself is maintaining itself within the objectives of the program to prevent that contamination from getting into groundwater. So for the complex systems, we would have an annual touch point back with them. And for the other ones, we'd essentially be looking at a one-time fixed cost fee.
Okay, and currently, once you issue the permit?
And in the permit program, if it's under a WPCF permit in the program, we would have a five-year renewal or a 10-year renewal, depending on the types of systems and the particular facilities that we're permitting.
Okay. And then why don't you continue on the list? Because you talked about revising the rules. Those were last done
in year 2000, Madam Chair.
Okay.
In terms of issuing permits under this program, we've managed to issue one permit under this program. It's to the City of Portland. And we have about six or seven permits applications in the office that we have not been able to work on for the last couple of years, actually.
And these are larger?
These are larger municipal systems looking at, probably hundreds of wells in those systems and putting together a program for those particular wells. And that would include things like a monitoring program, identifying what things to monitor, the frequency of monitoring, the reporting back to the department, and looking at those systems. In terms of revising rules, as we've spoken to, we've already done that. In terms of an outreach program, we, in fact, have not been able to do very much outreach in this particular program. Those opportunities that we have had have been very limited to several of the cities, but the response that we've gotten from people through that outreach has been great. And people have, in fact, very much enjoyed the outreach and understanding what the program is and getting a handle on what we do under the program. And so, again, very little. In terms of the database, we have a database currently, and this would allow us to continue to update that database and enter into the system all the information from the registrations, and in addition, any of the data that we will be getting through this system, through the program, into that database.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quickly on the fee, proposed fee amendment that you have in your testimony. You've got for geothermal facilities $10,000, which is significantly higher than anything else, and I'm just curious why, and just to put it in context, I mean, one of the things that we're all working on very hard is trying to incent development of renewable energy technologies, and that almost seems like a disincentive. Could you please explain that?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, what we're talking about here in this particular fee category are the very large geothermal operations. For example, developing a geothermal field at Newberry. We're not speaking of having very many of these, and it's really the large type of developments, and not a single well that a homeowner might have or that type of thing for geothermal. But where we are actually putting down a number of wells,
bringing up, you know, the warm water, putting it through some type of system, and then injecting it back down into the ground. But we're talking about mega systems, and I would not expect us to have very many at all of these types of systems. But in fact, to look at them would take us a lot of time to make judgments on making sure that we were injecting those fluids back into the aquifer or the location of the geothermal development.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Well, we have lots of people that would like to testify in this, so I'm sure you will be sticking around. Thank you very much, Neil. First, I'm going to call up the folks who came furthest today, and that is Mike Miller from the City of Bend. I have Shannon Taylor from the City of Redmond and Barb Atkins. You don't live further. You know, you're further 100 miles from Gresham. So if you could all come up, please, I'd appreciate it. And just make sure and state your name for the record. And if you have any testimony to hand out, you can give it to committee staff. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Shannon.
You can pull the mic towards you. They do move. There you go. Thank
Better.
You.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Shannon Taylor, and with me is Barb Atkins, and we're pleased to represent the Groundwater Protection Coalition here today. The coalition consists of the cities of Bend, Eugene, Gresham, Milwaukee, Portland, and Redmond, the counties of Clackamas and Multnomah, and TriMet, all of which utilize underground injection control devices for the disposal of stormwater. The coalition was established to ensure that the protection of Oregon's groundwater remain at the state level with proper funding for Oregon's DEQ program. It's essential to the coalition that the proposed funding adequately provide for increased DEQ service levels required by our representative communities. The coalition supports House Bill 2118, the Groundwater Protection Act of 2007. We believe it's important for DEQ to retain the UIC program to facilitate development and allow developers to select proven and cost-effective options while still protecting groundwater quality. Coalition members believe that these interests are best served by a state-administered program. Proper state funding will allow for timely reviews of new devices, development of guidance documents, technical assistance, and permit processing and issuance by staff with knowledge of local issues, which benefits both agencies and the development community. And with DEQ retaining the program, we can work with DEQ to improve the current UIC rules and to consider innovative or green technologies for stormwater and treated wastewater effluent. The coalition has worked extensively to prevent the return of the UIC program to EPA by working with DEQ to formulate the fee table proposed in Amendment 1 to House Bill 2118. Under the proposed structure, DEQ will charge fees to rule authorized permit or decommission UIC systems. The coalition believes that the proposed fees are fair, reasonable, and easy to implement, and will adequately fund the program and increase the levels of service provided by DEQ to our agencies and development community.
Madam Chairperson and committee members, for the record, my name is Barbara Adkins. And in follow-up to what Shannon was saying, the coalition also represents Amendment Number 2 that DEQ mentioned. Amendment Number 2 revises Oregon Statute 468.135 to allow penalties recovered from UIC violations to be paid into the Watershed Grant Fund administered by the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. We believe this will allow for beneficial use of penalty monies for on-the-ground water quality improvement projects. If House Bill 2118 is not passed, DEQ will return the program to EPA. It's our concern that EPA administration will result in an enforcement-only program, cause significant delays for development projects, and potentially cause economic impacts for some communities. Under EPA administration, agencies would be in a position of increased regulatory uncertainty with a potential for increased liability from third-party lawsuits. State protection of Oregon's groundwater is vital to the continued protection of our aquifers and drinking water. We, the members of the coalition, urge you to pass House Bill 2118 and keep the future of Oregon's groundwater in local hands. Thank you very much for your time, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Mike?
Well, good afternoon. Chair Dingfeller and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Miller. I'm the Assistant Public Works Director for the City of Bend. Thank you for the invitation to testify on HB 2118 today. City of Bend relies heavily upon groundwater for its municipal water supply. In fact, the city has won numerous awards over the years for its quality of drinking water. Therefore, protecting groundwater is one of the city's highest priorities. Most of the stormwater within the city is injected underground by means of UICs. DEQ administers the federally mandated Safe Drinking Water Act, UIC program, in Oregon. Under this program, DEQ must review all new UICs for compliance with Oregon UIC regulations and authorizes construction only after it is satisfied that groundwater is being adequately protected. The only funding DEQ has received for operating the UIC program is for 0.85 FTE, and that is coming from directly from the US EPA. This is not sufficient funding for a program that receives thousands of UIC applications on a yearly basis. Due to the lack of funding, DEQ has not been able to provide technical assistance, develop guidelines, or policies that would make the authorization process more efficient and effective. DEQ has not been able to issue authorizations to construct in a timely manner, and this has led to development delays. Because of these delays, UICs are being installed without DEQ authorization and an adequate level of protection to the groundwater. HB 2118 would authorize DEQ to assess reasonable user fees for all new UICs. This is broadly supported by a vast majority of those who would have to pay the fees, including the city of Bend. I think we're unique in actually coming in and asking for fees to be placed upon us. City Bend has over 4,000 UICs that we currently own and operate. The alternative to DEQ operating the UIC program is for the program to revert back to the EPA. This would have several serious consequences in the general public, for the general public, developers, businesses, and municipalities. We strongly urge you to support and pass HB 2118. Thank you.
Thank you. And I apologize for having to step out for a minute. Representative Cannon.
Question. I'll direct it towards you, Mr. Miller, although you two also represent municipalities or agencies. But you, Mr. Miller, mentioned that you have 4,000 UICs, and my understanding is that you would not actually pay the fees that are proposed here, that you would instead apply for a permit.
That's
maybe
correct.
You already have a permit that... I believe it's the Water Pollution Control Facility permit that covers all of those UICs. Is that correct?
Yes. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, yes, that is correct. We have applied for our WPCF permit. It's been in the queue for over 2 years, 2.5 years now. But what it comes down to is the private development side of things, whether it's a private subdivision, a Lowe's, a Target, those type of facilities would have to put in for a permit or rule authorization, and that is the delay that we are seeing within our community.
Okay. Follow up. So the city of Bend would not be slapped with a $400,000 hit here for the 4,000 permits that it operates times the $100 per registration fee, and I'm sorry that I don't know, perhaps the registration fee is only assessed on an application for a new UIC, so it might be misleading to suggest that it would even be considered. But I guess I'm just trying to understand who really pays this fee, and I'm wondering if large municipalities or agencies like the ones that you represent will actually pay the fee that's being proposed here today.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think the answer to your question is a lot of the fees that will be paid could either a developer could either choose to apply for a general permit, which those fees are already established, or a municipality could choose to apply for an individual permit, which the fees are established already for that. I think it's $8,000-something for an individual permit fee. So this would affect any private development subdivisions going in that wouldn't have public right-of-way associated with them, parking lots, things like that. And those devices still would affect
potentially public water supplies, private drinking wells in the community.
Okay. I appreciate the clarification. Cool. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming over today and testifying on this very important piece of legislation. One of the things that I think might be helpful is we've heard several different bills actually dealing with this issue of primacy under Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act, and I think it'd be helpful if we had a little bit of an example. You know, by maintaining the primacy and DEQ being in charge of this program, what kind of technical services and programs are we getting that we would not have if we were to lose that and were to go back to EPA?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I think what we'd be receiving is we'd get some revised rules. We'd get to participate in that process. We'd get technical guidance that would include things like what kind of treatment facilities are appropriate for different locations, depending upon the pollutants you would expect, whether it's a high traffic street or a parking lot or like a loading dock. So there would be guidance out there that would say a swale is appropriate for this type of location for these types of pollutants. We'd also get personal technical assistance. We'd be able to pick up the phone and call our local reviewer and say, would this work? This is what we're proposing. Here's a new technology. Can we consider this? So I think it would be those types of things. And we'd also have a shorter review time. Currently, it's 90 plus days for an individual developer to up to 90 days to get a review of a single or 10 UICs for a subdivision or a private industrial facility. So, and that's reduced down from anywhere, depending upon whether it's simple to complex, from 7 to 45 days, if I remember correctly. So we would get those types of things, and those are things that we really need, because when you're putting a plan together, it's nice to know ahead of time what's accepted. It's kind of like our public work standards and our water quality manual, so you know what your choices are ahead of time, so it makes it more streamlined in the long run.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. We also have a representative from the EPA here, so I think we will also call him up next. So,
Chair, may I
follow up?
One other question, please. Yeah. Thank you. Have you seen these proposed fees?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Burley, we actually participated on a work committee to help develop those fees with DEQ.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate you coming over. And I apologize because we have a Ms. Rodriguez from the U.S. EPA, and I'll ask Ms. Rodriguez to come up now if you can. And I'm also, just to make sure that we keep moving, I will ask Dean Marriott from the City of Portland. And I will ask Alex Kylo from the City of Eugene to come up. Thank you for being here, Ms. Rodriguez. Are you from the Seattle office?
No, I'm from Portland recently.
Great, thank you. And for the record, can you state your name and affiliation?
Good afternoon. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. As I was trying to say, I'm the director of EPA's Oregon Operations Office, which is part of Region 10, covering three northwestern states and Alaska. We are unique among EPA regions in having state offices. So,
Thank you. So
I appreciate the opportunity to speak regarding House Bill 2118. I'm here today because EPA strongly supports this bill. We support the efforts of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality to protect the public health of Oregonians by ensuring the safety of their drinking water. House Bill 2118 allows the Environmental Quality Commission to take the actions necessary to implement the Underground Injection Control Program of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. The UIC program, as we've heard this afternoon, protects groundwater from contamination by regulating the injection of fluids into the ground. As we've also heard, groundwater is a critical source of drinking water for Oregonians, and a huge percentage of Oregonians rely on groundwater for their drinking water. And we've also heard that it's not treated before drinking primarily. So at present, the DEQ has primacy, has authority and responsibility for the implementation of the UIC program in the state of Oregon. I'm here to show support for HB 2118 because the fee-based structure in this bill is needed to sustain the UIC program in Oregon. These fees, which would be placed in a new subsurface injection fluids account, would be appropriated by DEQ to pay the administrative costs, which are obviously substantial for implementing this program. And that would enable DEQ to continue their longstanding role of directly implementing the UIC program in partnership with EPA. We're not exactly going away totally. So we at EPA, if I can sound vaguely regal and federal, we applaud the efforts of Oregon to implement the fee-based program, not really, as a critical step towards ensuring that the UIC program has the resources it needs to meet the demands created by regional growth and development. It's pretty obvious that this is an area of robust growth, and all of that growth puts a lot of pressure on this program, spurs the need for UIC wells and regulatory oversight. As we've heard, even from the people who would end up paying the fees, they recognize that these fees are needed to sustain this program. It's regional growth that makes the UIC program so important to the continued safety of drinking water in Oregon. So as I said a moment ago, I want to be clear that EPA is not going away, and by that I mean our funding is not going away. We believe that the federal funding will continue to be an important component of the UIC program in Oregon and across the country. We all also recognize that federal funding for UIC does not keep pace. I wouldn't say not always. I'd say it does not keep pace, has not kept pace with the demands for services faced in the UIC program. You've heard that it's less than one person, less than one full-time equivalent that's funded right now. So in the past year, the DEQ has discussed with EPA the reality of the funding, serious funding constraints, and the possibility that the UIC program would have to be returned to EPA. And as you can see, the funding level has been about the same for the last 10 years. I don't think I'm telling any secret by reminding us all that the federal government itself is under some budget constraints. Just recently, this year, we're under a continuing resolution for our entire fiscal year, which is, if not unique, certainly pretty rare. So we're not expecting to anytime soon to have increased funding available for this program, and that makes this bill very important to Oregon's UIC program. As you've heard others say, I'll emphasize that if the UIC program were to be returned to the EPA, it would be the regional office in Seattle, probably not the Oregon Operations Office, but the Seattle office, who would be doing a very limited sort of program, primarily focused on enforcement and inspections, enforcement actions where necessary to encourage compliance. We probably would have very limited ability to provide technical assistance, and review times for permit applications would likely be long. So we believe that the current Oregon UIC program is a well-designed program, and if properly funded, can be even more effective to protect the state's groundwater resources, including our underground resources or underground sources of drinking water. We very much support the proposed fee structure for the state's UIC program. And we at EPA believe that the best UIC program, the most effective one, is one that continues to be implemented by the state of Oregon, in the state of Oregon, to maintain a program that's responsive to the interests of Oregonians. So thank you very much for the opportunity to comment today.
Well, thank you, Ms. Rodriguez. We appreciate it. I do have one quick question before we move on to the other witnesses. That is, how are the other states in Region 10 dealing with this? Do they have primacy? And if so, do you know if they charge fees for their program, or do you operate for some of the other states?
In Idaho, the water program is operated by EPA, so it's different from Oregon in that way. And the same is true for Alaska. Both of those states are in the process of changing that. And I don't know about Washington. I don't know if there's a fee structure or not. Maybe someone else.
But they have primacy over there.
Yes. And I don't know whether they have a fee structure.
Okay. Thank you. We'll have DEQ check on that for us. So, okay. Alex, thanks. I was going to let my city go first, but that's okay. We're happy you're here, Alex.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm a legislative analyst with the City of Eugene, and you've got testimony there by Peter Ruffier, our wastewater management division director. I wanted to make a couple points. One is that the staff at the wastewater division find this to be a very important piece of their legislative effort this year from the City of Eugene's perspective. They did join the Groundwater Protection Coalition and have put a fair amount of resources into making sure that this bill does get passed, in that there's the degree of uncertainty in terms of if this program does go back to the EPA. There's some concern there that the guidance won't be in place that we need. And I want to specifically, we've got a concern because we developed management plans for stormwater, and in especially one area of Eugene, the River Road, Santa Clara area, where water tables are very high. There's some big questions about how deep these wells can be, and they really want to be able to have that kind of local ability to access staff, which was mentioned by some of the other cities. There's two other points I'd like to point out with regards to the letter that we submitted. One is that we see this as part and parcel of the city's efforts at moving forward with our kind of green building efforts, somewhat akin to the issue that this committee is also faced with biofuels. Green building is another area where we're trying to move forward with, and the management, the design, a permitting of bioswales and other kinds of alternative stormwater management systems are kind of part of our quiver in terms of the tools that we have to green up the city. And then finally, I wanted to point out that the Wastewater Management Division is ISO 14000 certified agency. That's the International Standards Organization, and that kind of certification depends to a very large degree on documentation and policies and procedures that are highly kind of strict and documented. And so the idea of having a program that doesn't have a whole lot of guidance makes us nervous from that perspective as well.
Okay. Cool.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. I'm Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director for the City of Portland. The city is pleased to be here in support of this legislation. Groundwater is obviously important to us. Believe it or not, even in the City of Portland, we rely on groundwater for drinking water supplies. It is our backup drinking water supply. There's been a lot of references to underground injection control devices. I call them sumps. We actually don't inject anything. It makes it sound like we hydraulically load some cannon and shoot it into the to the ground. This whole term really stems from the early 1970s, when the Congress and the Safe Drinking Water Act was trying to address the oil and gas industry that, in fact, was injecting oil and gas waste into the aquifer in Texas and Oklahoma. Part of that legislation did mention stormwater, so that's where this urban stormwater issue has finally come to rest. But these sumps do play a very important role. They do, in fact, recharge groundwater. So in an urban area like Portland, where we're interested in temperature of our streams and recharging the groundwater and not overloading our surface waters with flashy runoff from storms, these kinds of sumps really do play a positive role as far as protecting the environment. They also, in fact, save us from having to dig up all of our streets to provide other piped systems for the infrastructure. So I wanted to emphasize there are some very positive attributes of these systems. Now, it's been mentioned that Portland has already received a permit, the first permit issued by DEQ. Just want to mention why that was the case. Not because we are special. We actually paid to develop the protocols for the sampling that will be used by the DEQ for other communities in the state. So we stepped forward and offered to do that, working in collaboration actually with EPA's lab in Corvallis to develop the protocols for the sampling. And I, like others, I want to second the notion that it's very important to maintain this program run out of the state of Oregon. As much as we like and respect EPA, they're not always available to us, and the state DEQ is. So that's an important role. So with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for the panel?
Chair Dingfelder, may I just make one
sure.
Small clarification? In addition to the written testimony. The other thing I handed you, this double-sided, is a copy of a letter from our regional administrator, Elon Miller, very much supporting this legislation as well. So thank you very much again.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it. Okay, next I'd like to ask up Lindsay Capps from the Oregon Environmental Council. This will be an interesting panel, John Chandler and John Ledger. I don't see John Ledger here, though.
Are you going to fill in for him, Doug?
Okay, is there anybody else here from the Association of Oregon Industries? No. Okay, thank you.
Chair Dinkfelder, members.
I noticed there's a chair in between you guys, but well.
Who am I and why am I here? Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Lindsay Capps. I'm legislative director of the Oregon Environmental Council, and we strongly support HB 2118. We believe Oregon's underground injection control program is important, both from a human health and environmental perspective. There are, has been testified to, there are thousands of UICs around the state. DEQ registers about 1,200 to 1,500 per year. And many of the storm drains and manholes you see in Bend or Redmond or the Portland metropolitan area, among other towns and cities across the state, lead to UICs, where stormwater is sent into the ground. If UICs are improperly designed, installed, or maintained, they can contaminate groundwater, which is a source of drinking water for more than 70% of all Oregonians. So that's an important fact. The problem we have is that funding for Oregon's UIC program, which is administered by DEQ, is currently limited to federal funds that pay for less than one full-time staff person, which is just not adequate. Last year, DEQ proposed returning this program to the EPA because of the lack of funding to adequately implement the program. The Seattle Regional EPA office also does not have the capacity to operate the program, so would have relied primarily on complaint-based enforcement and not enough in terms of providing the added benefit of technical assistance and guidance. We don't think it makes sense to have a complaint-based program based outside of the state of Oregon to protect something that is underground and therefore is not visible to the public, and yet is a critical resource for providing Oregonians with clean and safe drinking water. The option of returning the program to EPA just is not an acceptable one in our eyes. The Environmental Quality Commission was right to reject the proposal to return the UIC program to EPA and to direct DEQ to develop an alternative solution, and we're very supportive of the work that was done with DEQ, municipalities, and other UIC users, including Mr. Chandler here, to develop a recommended set of fees. And we think that's a very good thing to move forward with, and obviously the proposal before you today would do that. I also want to note that retaining a workable UIC program in Oregon is also important because other innovative and sustainable stormwater management practices such as bioswales, stormwater planters, and pervious pavement are sometimes considered as UICs since they allow stormwater to infiltrate into the ground. We believe greater clarity is needed in DEQ's UIC rules as they relate to these practices, and the additional staffing this proposal provides will allow for these program improvements. So in short, we support this bill and urge the committee to pass HB 2118. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chandler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association. I'd first like to express my appreciation to Ms. Marriott for explaining where the underground injection part of UIC came from. I spent the better part of a year and a half trying to figure out what the heck a UIC was, and then I realized it was a fancy name for a dry well. I'd never actually heard the genesis. Good bill should pass. We support it. We appreciate DEQ's reasonable fee structure. My members do a lot of these, particularly in East Multnomah County and over in Central Oregon. We share with others. No disrespect to our friends in the federal government that giving this program back to EPA would be a remarkably bad idea. Tempting, but not productive. We urge the bill's passage. We support the amendments. And thank you very much. We're glad to take any questions.
Representative Burley.
I have to ask, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Now, Lindsay, you're twice. You're the second time now. What is a bioswale?
Oh. Well, I'd actually defer to DEQ to explain that in a rational way.
Stump the witness. I think probably John.
It's a filter stormwater rather than having it go directly into a
into a storm drain.
Okay, so that's kind of what I
think. Madam Chair, in our burly, we used to call them ditches.
Very sophisticated term.
The consultants can't charge as much otherwise.
Well, I just thought maybe we were missing something in the biofuels bill or something.
If it stays in this way long enough, it becomes a biofuel.
We can get you pictures, and there may be one in your neighborhood that you may not even be aware of, but thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. We appreciate it. Mr. Riggs.
Madam Chair, for the record, Doug Riggs with NGRC on behalf of the Groundwater Protection Coalition. I wanted to explain that I believe Mr. Ledger is under the weather today, but AOI has been briefed on this program and indicated their support for the bill as well.
Okay, thank you. And are there any other folks that would like to come up and testify on this bill? Okay, we actually would like to ask, Neil, if you can come back up. We had a couple other questions in the waning minutes here. We're wondering if you can walk us through Section 4. The Vice Chair and myself had some questions about that, the in lieu of a permit requirement. And I am about to pull out the statute, but maybe you can just sort of walk us through that. In particular, I was interested in how de minimis discharges are defined.
Madam Chair, I'm looking through the section right now, if I could. In terms of the fluids themselves, the current program allows us to basically authorize the injection of a certain type and category of injections without people having to come in and actually get a permit. And the permit would, you know, add additional requirements to that. We would have, say, for example, reporting requirements, sampling requirements, and we're reporting back to us annually on what they would be actually sampling and monitoring. And so Section 4, Sub 2, would allow us under this program to exempt people from actually having to get permits and allows us to authorize them without permits. Okay. Currently, under the ORS, if you're injecting waste fluids, that is, you know, some type of waste that has gone through a treatment system into the ground, you would have to get a permit for that. And we're trying to identify specific categories that would not need those permits.
And you currently have an exemption. Is there a threshold under when you say de minimis? I'm assuming it's a certain amount.
We do not have currently a threshold for de minimis, Madam Chair. It's something that, you know, the department has looked at it specifically in different categories. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as we develop permits, we try to identify specifically for that type of activity what would be a de minimis amount for that category. For example, if we were looking at a permit for wineries that are injecting or are disposing of fluids from the wining process, we would look to see if they were below a certain amount of actual fluids and determine whether or not they would actually have to have a permit for that.
Okay, and all of these would be done through rulemaking process, is that correct, if I'm reading that right?
Madam Chair, yes, that would be correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mullane, I'm going to go back to where I started out with this. Is just trying to understand, now that I've observed that there are 45,000 registered UICs in Oregon, gathering that the typical homeowner who has a downspout that runs into the ground, that's not a permitted UIC.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay, so, but at what scale does it become a registered UIC? What is it? Is it based on volume of runoff?
Madam Chair, Representative, what we tried to get to is really the whether that particular sump or well is likely to have contaminants associated with it. And then as we look at those contaminants, we try to look to see whether or not there is a risk to the drinking water from the placement of that particular well with those particular contaminants and the volume that's going into it. For example, if we're looking at street runoff and we're looking at the number of cars, if you look at the fee table, we try to make a division in terms of the amount of traffic and vehicle traffic that are going through a particular, say, section of road and the sump that is servicing that particular section of road. And the more cars and more activity that you have, the greater likelihood you have of contaminants being discharged on the road surface. And then when we do have a rain event and we're picking up those contaminants and moving them into that sump and then injecting them into the ground. We really want to take a more active role of looking at those particular ones, those particular sumps, to make sure that contamination is not entering the ground.
Just one more, Madam Chair, if I could. I think it's just one more. If it's a registered, I mean, if the risk of contamination is what drives then the permit requirement, how does the person who is creating a runoff situation or a dry well, an injection system, without maybe realizing that's what it would be called, how do they know in order to pursue a permit? How would I know if I had a small commercial building and there was this kind of risk? How would I know that I needed to go get a permit? How would you get out there in the first place?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, in the application process itself, we identify on our webpage the material somebody would need to apply for the registration and for the authorization. And going through that process of filling out that application, we identify the key factors that we're looking at in terms of placement of the well, association with traffic, depth to groundwater, the key factors physically for that particular system and whether or not it would be a risk. And then as we review, and then the numbers of them, the number of, say, for example, in a parking lot, if you have a whole series of wells in that particular parking lot, we're looking to see whether or not injection across that entire area would be causing a problem. And so the application itself would identify the numbers of wells over a particular area, the depth of the groundwater in that particular area. Is there any separation between the bottom of that particular sump and the ground itself, the groundwater itself, and whether or not we can rely on that particular separation to filter out contaminants. So the application goes through the process of getting us those key pieces of information that then we review and to make that determination of whether or not that particular well can be, in fact, authorized or whether or not we need to go through a permit process and specifically identify requirements for that particular well.
And I'm wondering if anybody from the city would like to come up and talk about the coordination, because I'm assuming somebody comes to you for a development permit, you're going to have a whole series, a checklist or whatever of things need to be aware of.
Can I break in, Madam Chair? What I'm concerned about is not how, once you're in the application process, that then I understand you have standards that you apply. What I'm wondering is if I'm a person who's out there dealing with runoff that's coming into onto my property, how do I know I even go to your website that I even need to make an application? I mean, I have to confess, I'm learning for the first time about the underwater.
We're on the record here, Representative McPherson.
I would never have known that I needed to search this out. And so I'm just wondering whether, in addition to the 45,000 registered uses or permitted uses, whether we have a lot of others where people are just ignorant that they have this obligation.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, you've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what my testimony identified, the fact that we have 45,000 that we've registered, but we suspect there are a great number of people out there who do not know that, in fact, these requirements exist. And the lack of our ability to go out in any type of say, public education outreach program and actually get the word out to people that are covered by this program is one of the things that is lacking in the program. We, in fact, are basically inundated. The less than one person is inundated with all the applications that are coming in now, and we haven't really been able to, in a number of years, been able to go out and actually, you know, inform people, have public education programs and that type of thing. And I'm sure the cities here could talk to the facts in terms of how they find out about it and the way they work with the individuals that are covered by the program. But no, you're right.
I probably pursued it as far as is useful.
Well,
I'd
just
the day,
like, if you could just comment, since we have the cities right here, I think that would be helpful, because this is the challenge of the program.
Yeah, Chair Dean Felder and Representative McPherson, from the city's perspective, when somebody comes in and proposes a plan to develop on a piece of property, whether it's a single-family home to a large-scale development or a industry, they have to go through a permit process, and that catches. We look at the stormwater system that they're proposing, and so at that point, if it's going to discharge to groundwater, we notify them and say, now you need to go register this with DEQ and get rural authorization.
It's part of the building permit.
It is. And we communicate with DEQ very closely with that.
And I would imagine, I don't know if there's anybody from the counties, I imagine the county, same type of development process occurs.
I believe so.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just through the development review process, the municipalities also have an obligation to protect their water supply. And so that's part of, we actually require that a rule authorization letter be given before they're given a building permit or they're allowed to construct their project. So
great. Thank you for that clarification. We appreciate it. Hopefully that solves the conundrum for
you. The mystery
you.
Is...
Well, it is. I mean, that's why it's so important. That's one of the reasons the cities are all here at support, because that could hold up a development process. If somebody's coming in, they can't get their UIC permit, then that sort of backlogs everything else within their process. So I appreciate that clarification. I want to thank everybody for coming here today. And unless anybody else would like to come up, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2118 and close the House Committee on Energy and Environment.